welcome to Arbitral Insights, a podcast series brought to you by our international arbitration practice lawyers here at Reed Smith. I'm Peter Rocha, Global Head of Reed Smith's International Arbitration Practice. I hope you enjoy the industry commentary, insights and anecdotes we share with you in the course of this series, wherever in the world you are. If you have any questions about any of the topics discussed, please do contact our speakers. And with that, let's get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our Arbitral Insights podcast series. And I'm delighted today to have as our guest none other than Cyril Schroff. Hello, Cyril.
Hi, Gautam.
It's great to see you as always. Now, Cyril is someone who really needs no introduction. If you just say Cyril, everyone knows it's him. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about Cyril because I've had the joy of knowing Cyril for a very long time, and he's a very special person. Cyril isn't just a legendary name in the law in India. He's a legendary name in the law globally, and rightly so. He is an incredibly highly respected practitioner in many areas of law, particularly corporate, securities, banking, insolvency, and infrastructure. He also started out, as I'm sure, Cyril, you will tell us in the course of our discussion, as a disputes lawyer. And Cyril still has an incredible knowledge and reputation in that field, such that most recently, to add to his many accolades, he was appointed to the board of directors of the Singapore International Arbitration Center, SIAC, something we'll speak about in the course of this podcast. Cyril is the managing partner of Cyril Amarchand Mangaldas, India's leading law firm. It has offices all around India. Cyril himself is based in Mumbai, the wonderful city of Mumbai. And the firm, not too long ago, opened an office in Singapore. And I'm sure there'll be more expansion strategies in Cyril's mind. But CAM, as it's known, is rightly regarded as one of the premier law firms globally, not just in India. It's a firm that many of our listeners will know very well. And I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard of Cyril, have come across Cyril, worked with Cyril, met Cyril. He really is an incredible thought leader in so many respects. So Cyril, it's a real privilege for me, despite having known you for such a long time, to be doing this podcast with you. It really is a personal honor. So thank you for joining this podcast.
Well, thank you, Gautam, and that was very, very kind of you. Of course, I've known you for now almost 3 decades. And it's been an absolute joy and privilege. And thank you for inviting me for this. So I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. I certainly am on, too. So let me start with this, Cyril. Tell us a little bit about who, in the course of your long and illustrious career so far, in over 4 decades of practice, who have been your greatest career mentors and inspirations?
That's a great question, Gautam. So as you know, I come from a family of a long lineage of lawyers. So the firm was founded by my grandfather. So I think it kind of is very natural to assume that some of my primary mentors were from the family, and in particular my late father, and who, you know, the firm of course was very different during his time. But he was probably the one who influenced my professional personality the most, because he was an extraordinarily hardworking and brilliant lawyer, and I worked closely with him. So I think as far as my lawyer personality and professional personality is concerned, I think he influenced it a lot, and some of the lessons, the sort of basic lessons of life that I learned with him continue to be a big part of my thinking even today. So I think I would say, like, you know, 50% of the kind of mentorship bucket would definitely go to him. I never met my grandfather, but I think he's probably his value system percolated through my dad. So that's, I think, part one. And then, of course, you know, there is a whole miscellany of mentors, both lawyers and otherwise, who I've worked with, because, you know, in a career of 40 plus years, you come into contact with so many different people. You come into contact with leading businessmen, with bureaucrats, with politicians, with just thinkers and philosophers, and, you know, so many different people. And I think you learn something from every one of them. But some of the folks who had a influence on me have been some of the leading industrialists, because their evolution also coincided with the growth of India as well, and the concept of scale, the concept of believing in the India proposition, the concept of believing in, you know, next and younger generations as well. All of these, I think, I probably learned from some of my big clients as well. And then I get inspired by all sorts of different non-conventional forces as well. I think art is a big inspiration for me, art and artists. So when you look at, some of the leading artists, whether, you know, depending on whether they're painters or sculptors or whoever, and you go a little deeper and look into their life story, I think you learn a lot from them. So these are not necessarily direct mentors of mine who kind of sit and mentor me, but people from whom I have learned. So I think that, and I think every person, including you, we are all a collection of the different experiences that we've had with people and everything that we've learned or unlearned as well. So your collective totality of your persona is made up of all of this. And that would be true in my case as well.
Thank you, Cyril, for that. We are all, as you say, a product of many people. And fascinating to hear what you said there. As I mentioned in the introduction, Cyril, you recently just in October of 23, you were appointed to the board of directors of SEAC. And that's a wonderful accolade. It's great for SEAC. It's great for CAM. It's great for India. It's great for India's role in the world of arbitration. If you could just tell us a little bit about what your membership of the board of SEAC entails and how you see that role playing out for you.
So, Gautam, in the introduction, you mentioned that I started off my professional career as a disputes lawyer, and that is correct. I think almost for the first 10 years, I did only disputes work. I became a transaction lawyer almost a decade after kind of starting off. And that experience and knowledge is something which I hold quite dear to myself even today. And even as we look at, either corporate governance situations or even just advising our clients on transactions, there's always one part of your brain that is looking at things from a disputes point of view of what could go wrong in this as well. So that's the disputes sort of DNA that is kind of got embedded at a very early stage in me. Now, that being said, after the early 90s, after India liberalized in 1991, then onwards, I would say I kind of made a shift and pivoted more to the transactional side. And so I have been sort of doing that since then, though I occasionally do get involved in sort of large corporate disputes. So I think that when SEAC invited me, and I think it's for them to really say why they invited me, but I can only guess. It was not for my experience as a disputes lawyer, though of course that might have been in the background. I think given who CAM is and my leadership position in this, what I bring to the table as a sort of corporate lawyer, as a leading corporate lawyer, is really the knowledge of India and the Indian market. Now, India is incredibly important to the SIAC. It is important because, firstly, the number of disputes that India is on either side of it. Then also in terms of just the rise of India as an economy, I think in the last decade or so, we've seen that story going from strength to strength. So it is important that the SEAC has someone who understands the market and can, so to speak, deliver the market and give it that kind of local credence that may be required. Now, that being said, SEAC is an extremely well-known and popular institution in India. But there is obviously something more that they must have assumed that I can add. And speaking for myself in terms of my role, you asked me about my role. It's just been recent, it's just been a few months. So currently I'm listening and learning. And I think what I will do in terms of, you know, going forward is to bring a knowledge of where the institution can do better in terms of the corporate world, in terms of, you know, government and policymakers as well. It's a land of enormous opportunity, and it is also becoming very competitive. There are so many institutions that have been setting up, and there is more coming, whether in GIFT City or in Hyderabad, which already has an institution as well. So whilst navigating the complex Indian arbitration space, which is only growing, I think from CIAC's point of view, they have a ally in me. And from my point of view, I think it's ability to contribute to India's reputation as a world-class, you know, marketplace, which is willing to recognize the need and the efficacy of international institutions like the SIAC. So, but it's, while it's still early days, it's quite exciting. And as I said, I'm still learning.
Well, that's very interesting. And I've got no doubt that you'll be making a huge impact on the board of SIAC, especially because this blends into the next thing I wanted to ask you, given India's potential. It's now the world's fifth biggest economy. It's growing. It's got a very progressive culture. But as we know, disputes happen, and they're an inevitable fact of commercial life. And India has ambitions to become an arbitration hub.
Yes.
It's been openly stated at the highest levels of government in India. India wants to become that hub. And frankly, I agree with that. And as you know, I've spoken publicly at conferences in support of this. But I just wonder, from your perspective, if you could give your thoughts on these two themes. What's your vision for the development of arbitration in India, or I should say the continued development of arbitration in India? And secondly, what do you think needs to happen to make that dream of India becoming an arbitration hub happen?
Thanks, Gautam. And again, a question in two parts. So, first let's start with the dream of India becoming one of the largest economies and a major, you know, so economic superpower in terms of, you know, how the future will develop. So we are past the 75-year mark since independence and have described our journey to India at 100 as Amrit Kal, which is supposed to be, if you kind of take a metaphor of a human life, that it is supposed to be the most productive and the most auspicious period of a person's life, and same holds good for the country. So by every indication, applying that analogy, I think India is going to see enormous growth across different sectors, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's healthcare, whether it's technology, whether it's, you know, just public services, soft power in terms of the, you know, the entertainment that we provide, music, movies, whatever. Every aspect of life is meant for and is destined for greater growth. Now, when so much growth is happening, as you rightly said, there are disputes. And one of the sticks that India always gets hit by is the fact that your dispute system is too slow, your courts are overburdened, you know, it takes decades to get something resolved. And that becomes a dampener in terms of the confidence that foreign investors have, or, you know, just commercial counterparties have when they're dealing with India. So that's something which we have to fix. And it keeps coming up not only in individual, you know, negotiations, but it keeps coming up also when there is a zoomed out view that is taken, for example, in the World Bank Ease of Doing Business Index or, you know, any measure. There is one of the minus points that India always gets is your disputes, your enforceability of contracts and dispute resolution needs to do better. So I think we are self-aware of that as a nation. I mean, the Prime Minister downwards, everybody has mentioned it. The fact that we want to become an arbitration hub is an expression of that intent, that we've kind of realized that we have a problem here and we want to fix it. because it is something which is going to have a direct impact on our economic growth. And it's not a nice thing always to export all your disputes outside India, because implicit in that is that, you know, you guys are not able to fix the problem domestically. Now, there will always be a mix of domestic and foreign, but the fact that we need to become more efficient is common ground. So India needs to really up its game on you know, faster disposal of disputes and enforceability of contracts. And one obvious outcome of that is mediation and arbitration, because these are the court system can only be stretched to whatever extent it can. Even if you were to double or triple the capacity, it's still not going to solve the problem in terms of just the backlog of cases, which even if you apply a reasonable mathematical ratio, it's going to take 300 years to dispose of today's backlog. Now, that can't be right. So arbitration comes as the obvious solution for that, with a combination of domestic or international. Now, having set this vision for being a leading arbitration center in the world, then the question then becomes, you know, how? So as we sit today and we are, you know, having this conversation, a lot of changes have happened legislatively as well as in terms of leading judgments of the Supreme Court. And it would be fair to say that we are now quite an evolved pro-arbitration jurisdiction. A lot has happened in the last decade. Many amendments in 2015, 19, and last year as well. The courts have gone out of the way from, you know, there was a period of time when there was some vacillation on this. But today now, I think life is very clear that we are pro-arbitration, and a lot of impediments in terms of efficient arbitration have been taken away. So the foundation, I think, is well set. The second part of your question on, you know, what does India need to do for making ourselves an even better arbitration hub? So many things. I think firstly, it should just continue in the same stream where courts are recognizing and honoring the intent to be an efficient arbitration hub. The second, I think a couple of practical suggestions. I think what we need is separate arbitration court and bar so that there is more consistency. We need third-party funding, which we don't have today. We need imposition of costs for frivolous appeals and challenges. We might need to make mediation mandatory so as to see if we can cut down disputes even at that stage. The state and the public sector are the biggest litigants. And a lot of the arrears can be placed at that door. So there is a policy and a cultural reform required in terms of how the state should participate in early dispute resolution. And a number of efforts have been made towards that. So the state should sort of consider, you know, moving away from ad hoc to institutional arbitration. That will be a big change. And there are already some schemes. So for example, there is something called the Vishwas, Vivad Se Vishwas, which basically means resolution of disputes through discussion and through negotiation. And it's a way of resolving disputes where the government is on the, or the state is on the other side. And if you're already a judgment holder, so there's a mechanism by which you could pay a certain percentage of, or you can settle for a particular percentage of your claim, and it's disposed of and you're saved from a whole appellate procedure which could drag on for years. And I think that's an example of a very progressive, innovative idea of bringing down the arrears as well. But again, now zooming out again in terms of what should be done, I think the efforts of keeping up the pro-arbitration spirit, secondly, a number of tactical reforms like the kind that I mentioned to you, and I think the third is, as far as the state is concerned, because they account for large part of the volume, is to kind of get them to the table and dispose of so that there's no unnecessary litigation. And there are, you know, the reason which we will get to on some other occasion on, you know, why do the state entities, you know, carry everything upwards to the Supreme Court? Because, you know, there's no downside to doing that so long as, you know, you're fighting it and waiting till the highest court. So if we do these three things, I think we'll be making a big impact in terms of making India much more efficient dispute resolution and enforcement of contract jurisdiction. Because that's the bottom line. It's not arbitration for its own sake. It's about enforcing contracts and resolving disputes.
Thank you, Cyril. That was a very interesting set of responses to my questions. And I just wonder whether I could follow up with this, because I agree everything you've said. I'm in total agreement with you. And I'm a firm believer that India will become that hub. And I think it shouldn't take that long. I mean, people often say, how long will it take? I don't think it should take excessively long to achieve that. But one of the things that I wonder if you could just address is this. One of the criticisms that's often leveled at arbitration in India is that very often most of the arbitrators are retired judges. And that leads to inordinate delay in the process, truncated hearing slots, which suit the judge, but not the parties, the former judge and not the parties. And also, if I recall correctly, I don't have the exact date when this happened, but I think there was a recent high-profile conference in India where the president of India made a comment that one of the things holding back arbitration is the obsession with appointing judges as arbitrators. So now, ACAM itself has got a number of excellent lawyers who practice arbitration. And I would have thought, as is the case in the UK, in the US and other countries, that seasoned practitioners at leading law firms should be also taking appointments as arbitrator. Now, what do you think about this? Do you think it's a cultural shift that needs to happen? Is there too much deference given to former judges? How do we move the needle on this so that we actually get a much broader base of arbitrators in India, and also we ensure more women are represented as arbitrators in India?
No, thanks for that very, very interesting question. A couple of things. I mean, firstly, just that's the psychology of why we've seen more retired judges being appointed as arbitrators. Firstly, a couple of reasons in the past, now I know this is changing. One is that practitioners, particularly leading practitioners, are too busy. So there is a lack of availability of practitioners who have the time, because either there could be transactional lawyers who are busy with their kind of day job, or senior advocates who are also busy in court all of the day, whereas retired judges have more availability of time. But again, that's a circular question, because then at some stage they become part of the problem. So there are a couple of responses that we need. One is, I think there should be a general shift towards more institutional arbitration rather than ad hoc arbitration, which involves named judges. On a lighter note, I have seen clauses which say, then the arbitration clause, which actually says anyone other than a retired judge. So it's kind of the conversation.
I like that.
that's a kind of an indication of how this conversation is evolving, but it's not there yet. What are the other solutions? I think younger retired judges, because they are kind of more aware of the best practices and maybe willing to kind of move a little faster, and they might have relatively more availability of time. Senior practitioners could also be kind of incentivized to take these roles, and particularly when there's a very specialized kind of dispute and the practitioners have the required background. It's not yet very common, so I think it requires some cultural changes to make that happen. The third part, which is kind of a little away from the judge's question, is the Arbitration Act, as you know, has been amended to provide a maximum period within which the case has to be disposed of 1 year. And otherwise, there has to be reasons and you have to get the time extended and all that. So all that, I think, is also helping. So cumulatively, all of these changes are having an impact. I think in the short run, you will see a bit still more the old habits die hard, as they say. So you'll still see more judges being appointed. But the kind of the mood has changed. We are seeing more practicing lawyers come in as well. So some of our partners, for example, Shaneen, and who is an arbitrator, we see her getting a lot of appointments as well. And that change is happening, but it's a slow process before you develop. It goes back to the point I made a little while ago that we need a larger arbitration bar.
Thank you, Cyril. Yeah, I think these are debates that will run and run for a while. But I've got no doubt that things will fall into place. And I think there'll be so much momentum that at some point things will just happen as they're happening now. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on that.
Look, on the arbitration institutions also, we are seeing the rise of so many new arbitral institutions in India, whether it's the MCIA or now the IAMC in Hyderabad or the Indian Institute at Delhi as well. There's a new one coming up in GIFT City in Gujarat. So when you add all of this together, that's a lot. And they're all, you know, in the institutional model. So, you know, of course, SIAC and other international institutions will have their place and they bring a certain prestige to it. But the rise and rise of Indian institutions is also happening concurrently. So I think India is serious about solving this problem. Secondly, there's a regulatory push also. So the Securities and Exchange Board of India, SEBI, has recently come out with a circular which requires an online dispute resolution, ODR, using the arbitration method as well. So, you know, the Indian disputes ocean is large and you can only drink it kind of gulp by gulp. It's very hard to swallow the whole, you know, the ocean in one gulp.
Yeah, it's far too much of a gulp, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, well, thank you for that, Cyril. It's, you know, it's been a fascinating discussion with you. And thank you for sharing your thoughts so candidly and so interestingly. I want to, as I do in these podcasts, I always like to end these podcasts with some more lighthearted discussion. And we know from our feedback that our listeners really enjoy the lighthearted discussion as much as the more formal discussion in these podcasts. So I want to maintain that tradition and ask you some lighthearted conversation. So I know that you're a doting grandfather. You've got a lot of, you love to play with your grandchildren. But what are the other things that you do in your spare time that really excite you?
So quite a few things. I'm a big Bollywood buff. I think that's a very well-known fact. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by how some of the best movies made in India are a reflection of Indian life and culture, and you learn a lot from them. So I love the movies. I am an unabashed foodie as well. But on a more personal note, one of the things which I like doing, though I don't get enough time, is painting as well. So I like to kind of use the other side of the brain for that. And I find not only therapeutic, but I think also creative. And when your one is in the zone trying to create a piece of art, I actually find that in the week thereafter, my work is better as well. I don't know what the medical or the chemical explanation to that is, but it's a fact. So I do like sort of doing that. I love to travel. It's travel is not the easiest thing in today's, you know, crowded flights and crowded airports, but nonetheless, just seeing new places and having new experiences is something which I enjoy. And that's a big part of who I am.
On the subject of travel, name a few places that are particularly dear to you when you do travel.
So top of the list, of course, is London. because it's, apart from being a very interesting cultural place, I've always seen this as a sort of an intellectual capital of the world. The sheer variety of people from across different disciplines, and not just the law, I mean, there's just so many things that you meet over there on, you know, any single trip is incredible. That variety and depth, hard to find anywhere else. So I think that would be one of the, from a city's point of view. But I like a very different mix of travel as well. So last year, we went on our first kind of Masai Mara Africa safari as well. I found it. I sent you some pictures as well. So that was awesome. I also like to go to places which have a lot of historical value. So recently in December, we were in Spain and, you know, got a lot of time to spend in museums and, you know, visiting various and seeing various works of art as well. So that's sort of, so it's a balance between, you know, the more advanced commercial cities as well as just where there is almost no commerce, but just where you get different life experiences.
Thank you, Cyril. Well, it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to do this podcast with you. Thank you very much for taking time out to do this with me. I have known you for 3 decades now. Every conversation I have with you is always contains something I didn't know about you, and which is one of the joys of these discussions and why it's always really nice to talk about these sorts of mutual topics, because something new always crops up. And so, look, thank you very much for taking time.
I have a question for you.
Of course, you can.
What keeps you going? Because I've seen you, working very hard over so many years as well, and I don't think any signs of slowing down as well. What makes Gautam tick?
Well, no, wow. You know, this is, I mean, I'm delighted to answer your question. It's the first, you know, Cyril, you're also a man of firsts, because you're the first podcast guest who's turned the table and asked me a question. So, no, I think it's a multifaceted thing. I owe everything to my late parents. And they continue to be a great inspiration to me. And my desire to make them proud and happy will always be a thing that makes me tick in a big way. Secondly, my family, who, of course, you know, my wife, Emma, and our children are a constant source of motivation for me and make me tick. And they want to make me do things better because they make me better, because they inspire me. And thirdly, I just think, there's a lot of, we get so much passion from the people we work with. And we constantly learn. I mean, I think everything is about every case, every matter that we're involved in is about teamwork. And it's about learning, solving problems, finding solutions, being creative, going to your thought about art, about being creative. And it's just, and just always trying to be better, trying to be better and think, well, what could we do better? What have we learned from this? What can we learn from this? And it's actually interacting with so many people over the years who've become such dear friends. You know, we started out working together from lots of different jurisdictions, and I'm blessed to count so many people in many jurisdictions now as personal friends. So that is a very truncated answer to your incredibly incisive question. And thank you for being the first podcast guest to have turned the tables on me. So, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this, Cyril, and I look forward to seeing you very soon. And I wish you all continued success in everything. You know, I'm going to end this podcast in the way that I opened it, which is that you are apart from being an incredible person, you are an absolute legal legend, and you've set the benchmark for so many of us all around the world by what you've achieved and what you continue to achieve and what you stand for. So thank you very much for that too, Cyril. And I'll see you very soon.
Thank you, Gautam. You've been very kind. Thank you.
Arbitral Insights is a Reed Smith production. Our producer is Ali McArdle. For more information about Reed Smith's global international arbitration practice, email arbitralinsights@reedsmith.com. To learn about the Reed Smith Arbitration Pricing Calculator, a first-of-its-kind mobile app that forecasts the costs of arbitration around the world, search Arbitration Pricing Calculator on reedsmith.com or download for free through the Apple and Google Play app stores. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google Play, Stitcher, reedsmith.com, and our social media accounts at Reed Smith LLP on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship, nor is it intended to suggest or establish standards of care applicable to particular lawyers in any given situation. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome. Any views, opinions, or comments made by any external guest speaker are not to be attributed to Reed Smith LLP or its individual lawyers. All rights reserved.